Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Stay Current Podcast. I'm Cecilia Hikena.
And I'm M. Godi.
And we are research fellows at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. And along with Stay Current, we are sharing knowledge to improve child health around the globe. So today we have another episode of the JPS Podcast. And this time we are highlighting articles from the first quarter of 2024. And for that, we talked to each editor of the month. So for January, we talked to Dr. Romeo Ignacio.
My name is Romeo Ignacio. I'm the Trauma Medical Director at Rady Children's Hospital at the University of California, San Diego. And currently I serve as the APSA Publications Chair.
In February, with Dr. Mark Davenport.
This is Mark Davenport, the UK Editor of Journal of Pediatric Surgery.
And in March, with Dr. Pablo Laje.
Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Pablo Laje. I'm a attending surgeon at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
The three articles we are covering today, we are talking about the use of antibiotics in complicated appendicitis, lengthening procedures for esophageal atresia, and the sensory function in patients after cryoanalgesia for the repair of pectus excavatum.
If you'd like to join and read the articles with us, check the links in the description below.
So the first article of the day is cessation of antibiotics for complicated appendicitis at discharge does not increase risk of post-op infection. So this is a prospective study done in one center in Utah. And we talked to the senior and first author of this paper.
I'm Scott Short. I'm an associate professor in pediatric surgery at the University of Utah and Primary Children's Hospital.
And I'm Katie Russell, also an associate professor at Primary Children's Hospital in the University of Utah.
So this study wanted to analyze the effectiveness of antibiotic therapy for complicated appendicitis. So what they did is they compared two cohorts in their hospital.
We really defined our two groups by time frame.
And that was Dr. Short. He is the senior author of this paper.
Before and after near uniform implementation of the change in protocol, which essentially was stopping antibiotics at discharge. But for either provider preference or for patient factors, they weren't followed 100% of the time.
And they compare their outcomes.
They looked at deep space organ infections. They looked at length of stay, readmissions, the use of CT scans afterwards.
And that was Dr. Romeo Ignacio. He is the editor that chose this article. So they had 185 patients in the home antibiotic group and 121 patients in the no home antibiotic group. And what they found is there were no significant difference in deep organ space infection that required intervention, and there was no difference in the length of stay.
They also looked at secondary outcomes like C. diff infections, superficial site infections, length of stay, postoperative CT imaging, and readmission. Again, no difference. And so this, again, challenges the tradition of what some surgeons are doing, which is giving antibiotics and maybe too much antibiotics after discharge.
And again, that was Dr. Ignacio.
So what do you think about this?
Like, fortunately, the modern science shows us we might not have to keep doing what we're doing for the last couple decades. So I think this is a good proof of concept for post-op surgical management.
Yes, I found it really impressive that appendicitis is the thing that every pediatric surgeon has every day. And we're still discovering new things.
Talking about next steps, you know, we have studied this now institutionally, but we think it's important to study it on a broader scale. And our plan now is to roll this out to the Western Pediatric Surgery Research Consortium.
Should we go to the second article?
Yeah.
So second article of the day is from February 2024. Which is BAPS issue of Journal of Pediatric Surgery. This paper is from United Kingdom and called What Proportion of Children with Complex Esophageal Atresia Require Esophageal Lengthening Procedures? And we talked to the senior author, Dr. Bruce Jeffrey.
Hi, I'm Bruce Jeffrey. I'm one of the children's surgeons in Newcastle in the north of England.
So this is a 25-year experience. Description of 220 consecutive infants with esophageal atresia in Newcastle.
And that was Dr. Davenport. He's the editor that chose this article. And outcomes they looked at were the rate of retention of native esophagus, complications requiring thoracotomy, and rates of anastomotic leaks, strictures, fund application, and mortality. They had 215 esophageal atresia patients, and 13% of them had complex esophageal atresia. And of them, only 25 patients survived the repair. 14 patients were type A, 11 patients were type C esophageal atresia. Cecilia, I'm sure most of our audience know the differences between these types, but do you want to simply explain?
Yeah, okay. So type A and C are the most common. Type C is the most common and means an esophageal atresia with a distal fistula. And type A means pure esophageal atresia, meaning there's no fistula to the trachea.
Perfect. Let's go back to our patient population. So we said 25 patients survived the repair, and 18 of them had delayed primary anastomosis, and 7 had esophageal replacement. And 2 of the replacements were salvage procedures following a failed traction. And only 4 patients who had esophageal atresia were potentially treatable by traction.
Most oftenly they can, if you mobilize both ends sufficiently. The esophagus has got a great intrinsic blood supply, and you can easily mobilize it right down to the diaphragm and right up to the thoracic inlet, and it will stay alive.
And that was Dr. Jeffrey. He's the senior author of this paper.
So I suspect many of the cases that are being put forward for lengthening are because surgeons get cold feet about attempting a primary anastomosis.
The rest of the patients, where traction techniques had not been attempted, the native esophagus was retained in 80% of the cases, and the median time to esophageal continuity was 77 days. In conclusion, we can say, according to this paper, management of complex esophageal atresia without lengthening procedure can result with a similar rate of retention of the native esophagus, but with significantly less morbidity. And here's what Dr. Davenport said about this article.
And nevertheless, this is definitely a pushback series which extols relatively conventional open surgery, of course. It really does beg the question as to what role, and they would say, if any, lengthening procedures have in those with long gaps.
So I think unless you have an experienced surgeon who says, after maximal mobilization, I genuinely can't get this together, I can't see that esophageal lengthening is required. If we were anastomosing esophaguses with excess tension and the repairs were failing, you would expect us to have a very high incidence of esophageal replacement, and we don't. So most of these cases, the vast majority, are anastomosed without problems.
And the third paper of the day is long-term sensory function 3 years after minimally invasive repair of pectus excavatum with cryoablation. For this, we talk to the editor, Dr. Pablo Laje.
Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Pablo Laje. I'm an attending surgeon at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
So this study is a prospective cohort study from a single center in Phoenix, and they aim to quantify the long-term hyposthesia and neuropathic pain after the minimally invasive repair of pectus excavatum with cryoablation. So what they did is they selected all the patients that were under 21 years of age that presented for bar removal between November 2021 and May 2023.
Basically, what they did was just before taking the bar out, they tested, quite thoroughly for a cold and soft touch and pinprick.
And in this study, they enrolled 47 patients. In these patients, the median bar dwell time, meaning the time the patients have the bars inside, was approximately 2.9 years. And they had placed a median of 2 bars. Almost 81% of them were secure with pericostal sutures.
In paper, just about half of the patients had some degree of hyposthesia.
T5 was the most common dermatome with this hyperesthesia.
The area that was the problem was less than 5% of the entire surface that was treated with cryo. So in reality, it was just a very small percentage of the chest wall that was having this hyperesthesia.
And again, that was Dr. Pablo Laje.
Neuropathic symptoms were identified by 13% only of the patients, but none of them required treatment. So what they conclude is that in the long term, any minimally invasive repair or practice of clavatum that had cryo, a lot of patients will experience some sort of chest wall hyperesthesia, but it will be limited to one or two dermatomes, and chronic symptomatic neuropathic pain was very rare. So what I have to say about this paper, patients were evaluated still with the bars. And so I would love to see this test done without the bars. And also, I think the secure of the bars with pericostal sutures also can damage nerves. So I'm hesitant that what we are seeing is only due to cryo and not to these other factors that are playing a role.
I think just to say that this is a great start, but you're right. Before saying that that is a consequence of the cryo, I think it might be a good idea to repeat the study after the bar comes out.
It is so fascinating to see how many studies are coming out about cryoanalgesia and pectus management. And hopefully we'll have better and better results. And even though some people are still hesitant, we're trying new things. So it'll be interesting to see, for me, how we manage pectus patients 10 years from now.
Okay, so time to summarize. We first talk about the cessation of antibiotics in complicated appendicitis, and we found out that it may not be necessary to give antibiotics after the in-hospital treatment. We know we still need more multicenter studies, but this paper looks promising. Secondly, we talk about the lengthening procedures for esophageal atresia, and we saw that it may be reserved for very specific cases, since many of the complicated esophageal atresias can be treated by a primary anastomosis either at the newborn period or with a delayed anastomosis. Last, we talked about long-term effects of cryoanalgesia in minimally invasive repair of pectus excavatum, and we identified that even half of the patients had some sort of hyperesthesia that was circumscribed to one or two dermatomes. And also, we have to keep studying if that could be related to still having the bar on or with the way that they were secure.
So I hope you enjoyed this issue of the first quarter of the Journal of Pediatric Surgery article review podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Don't forget to follow us on social media, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and download the Stay Current app for tons of pediatric surgery content.
I'm Cecilia Hikena.
And I'm M. Godi.
And we are research fellows at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. And along with Stay Current, we are sharing knowledge to improve child health around the globe.